My name is Cheryl Easley. I'm going to be presenting this session and the next session on cultural respect with my twin sister, Carol Easley Allen. Unfortunately, Carol and I are double booked this morning, so she always does the late breaker session with Barry Levy. And so she's over to get started on that, and she has to give a paper on the tornado in Alabama that she lived through. And then, so after she finishes that, she's going to come over and take over, and then I'm going to go over there because I promised to do a session for them on prison health. So then we'll both be back for the second session. Thank you all for coming. How many of you are from the public health nursing section? Okay, so most of us are from the section, and this session grew out of some experiences that we had in the public health nursing section. And what we kind of heard through the grapevine is that some other sections had also some concerns, some issues about cultural diversity, cultural respect. So there were a group of people that at the section meeting last year that came together and talked about planning this. And so a number of people have been involved in planning this session. Okay, the disclosures. At the time that my sister and I had agreed to do this presentation, we were both employed at universities and we had no disclosures. Since that time, we both resigned from our positions at the universities where we were and have started a consulting business that provides consultation and workshops related to cultural diversity. So I just wanted to make that disclosure, but that was not the case when we started out. Okay, we want to give a special thanks to Dr. Jean Swinney, who's sitting right there in the front, because she wrote the abstract, framed this session for us, which was the framework for how the session was designed. And we just wanted to give her a very special thank you. Okay, ground rules. These two sessions are going to be partly didactic and partly interactive. So since we're doing interaction, we need to have some ground rules. And I will give you three that I think we should have, and then I would invite you, if you have others, that you would also propose some ground rules for the session, for our work together. The first one is, what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. And the second one is that we will listen to each other attentively and respond with respect and understanding. And the third is that with some of the interaction, you will be asked to, there's some self-disclosure, not anything major, but if at any point you feel that you would rather not, then feel free not to, and there's no judgment about that. That's your choice. We want you to feel comfortable here. The interactive pieces that we're going to use should serve two purposes. One, to help us begin to think about these issues, and second, perhaps to give you some ideas if you want to do similar kinds of work that you might be able to take something away from this. And we've had some good suggestions. Some of the things we've had in the past, Susan sent us a number of interactive things, and we've modified some of those. Certainly, we can't do all the kinds of things that are listed because we just don't have time. Even with, if you're here for the two sessions, we won't have time to use everything, but we can kind of begin to get some familiarity with some of those. And also, there are various types of resources, self-assessment tools and whatever, that if you will leave your business cards with us, we will email those resources to you after we get home. Are there ground rules that any of you would like to suggest? Yes.
Just clarify the confidentiality issue. Is it one of those
Yes, you can certainly take in information. Yes, but that just so that we feel free to interact with each other. Okay. Anything else? Okay. Oh, I guess I should tell you a little bit about myself. Of course, I'm a public health nurse. I have spent most of my life in educational, either in teaching in institutions, either in teaching or in administration. And my last job, I was a dean for a college that included not only nursing but other health professions. I've been, you know, given the nature that I'm a black woman, I've been dealing with cultural issues all my life and certainly all my professional life, with student issues, with issues at work. My sister and I have done some work together in this area and have done some writing together in this area. I've had the privilege to be able to travel a couple of times to places where I, out of the country, which were very enriching experiences. The first and probably one of the most impactful visits of my life was to the Missionaries of Charity in Calcutta. And Carol went on that trip also. Different culture, an entirely different world. And I've been fortunate also to been able to travel and work in Malawi doing HIV/AIDS education and training. Those kinds of experiences, and I always try to encourage opportunities for students to have those kinds of experiences. I think it's great to have people come from overseas, to have students, to have faculty, and I've been able to facilitate that with some work with China. But you know, it's one thing to have people come and tell you, but you never really get the feel until you've been there yourself and been the odd person and had to understand and respond to other people's culture and beliefs. So those have been very enriching experiences for me in my life also. Okay, I'm going to start with a case study just to kind of break the ice. We're going to do another interactive thing once we're both here that kind of helps us get to know each other better, but I wanted to wait until Carol was here so she could participate in that. So I thought I'd start out with this case study, which is actually a true story. Public health nursing education in a poor community. When I first moved to Michigan, I taught at a small denominational university. Many of our students, it at that point, had one of the highest proportions of international students in the country in that very small school, just because of the nature of the school. So many of the students, we had many students from overseas, from various countries. We also had many students who were, in quotes, American, but really had spent their lives in another culture because they were children of missionaries. We also had a large proportion of Caucasian students who, many of them, had grown up in very sheltered, enclosed kinds of contexts because of the church relationship. And many of them had grown up in rural communities and had never interacted with anyone that was not white, and probably not from our church. Now, I had the opportunity, which I was probably the best time I ever had teaching public health nursing, in a small town that was like it was a twin city. One was a very rich little community, primarily white, very affluent, and the other was a very, very depressed and poor African-American community, which had health statistics that you would not believe. I mean, this was back in the early 70s, mid-70s, and we had rates of tuberculosis that you saw in big cities. We had some of the highest rates of out-of-wedlock pregnancy in the state. There was, you know, it was on a drug corridor between Chicago and Detroit. The community was very depressed. It looked like a ghost town that had resisted efforts at urban renewal. And many of the people that lived in the little rich town next door worked in that town, but their funds, all their money and revenues went back to the rich community, and the poor community was just suffering. It had the problems of both rural and urban communities in terms of transportation, because there wasn't good bus service. You know, I would see mothers walking, carrying a baby and trying to lug groceries in the other hand. It was that kind of situation. So, but it was one of the richest places to do public health that I've ever taught in. Our students were able to have at least four or five families that they carried independently, in addition to having a school that they provided nursing in. They did scoliosis screening for the county. They did sickle cell counseling. They had all kinds of wonderful experiences. And so it was a great place to work, and the health department nurses were extremely receptive. We were able to do things together. That, remember, we used to do problem-oriented charting? Well, I used to teach that. I taught it to the nurses in the health department. That's what I wanted my students to use for charting, and so that was what we used in the health department. It was that kind of openness. It was really great. But families, on a regular basis, parents would come or call, or I'd hear through the dean of students that they did not want their children to go to that little city. And they thought it was unsafe, and why do they have to go there, and could they go someplace else? Okay, this is the problem then. And I was a young faculty member, and I got this constantly. So what I want you to do is to group yourselves into groups of maybe 3 to 5 and talk about it. If you were the faculty member, or if you were a public nurse in that agency, public health nurse in that agency that worked with the students, how would you manage that problem? What would you do? What would be the principles that you would think about as you planned your response? Yes. Yes. You might want to move your chairs around. Feel free to move your chairs around, but come forward. I want you all to participate. And we'll take a few minutes to do that, and then we'll ask the groups to report out.
Thank you. that there are, I'm not a faculty, so I really have no idea what it's like to work with two virgin students who have really no idea what it's like. I'm glad that, but I have had the experience of the health departments telling me that their nurses were anxious about the safety reasons, and they were struggling with how to deal with that. And part of it is getting to where a reasonable, there are situations that we should be.
Yeah, how do you deal with that?
Safety. Kind of rather than going to visit. Visiting the mom, helping home.
Yeah. Oh, right.
So, how do you distinguish from a distance as a manager or supervisor, where the real safety issues are, and towards issues that are more internal? That's a struggle for staying. Remember that there's some very rural areas of Oregon that are just, you're out there a long way, and you're really a hard example away from anybody. Your cell phone doesn't work, and then you get out of a valley, and you're just a long ways away, and you're going to situations where the reason you're going there is because it's a domestic violence, it's a tough area. That's why you have to go there. How do you help? It doesn't work for the sheriff, no one can talk to them. So, well, we've had, does the faculty do like you talked about? Did it become a thing that everybody had talked about in the group? That's interesting.
Yeah, I should say that. I went to the nursing school. I was just public health career. And now,
of start with.
Okay, I've been around to all the groups. I'm hearing some good ideas. So why don't we stop this and come back together and talk about what strategies you would recommend to me to deal with this problem? You can leave. You can still sit in small groups if you want. If that's comfortable, because we'll do some more group things. If that's comfortable for you. Okay, let me. This group doesn't want to stop. Yeah, I'll ask the group in the back if they would start. What strategies did you come up with, and why? And what kinds of things were important to you? Yeah. Other strategies. In that group, from another group.
some patients would say that, you know, if you have any problem, you know, you can come and pick you up from there. And when then other people said that in their agencies, that is not allowed. I use the example of my clinic where I used to have preceptorship of students, you know, from Columbia School of Nursing. And my mantra was, when I had an experience of some students going to a home and really making the mother of those children very uncomfortable, and I was chastised by a social worker, said that we will not have the students come to make home visits anymore if they don't come with this kind of attitude. So from then on, when my students came, I would have a one-line orientation, and that is very blunt. If you have any racist or racism, first of all, think of the patients that you're having here. They're human beings, like you and I. They have the same blood, the same cartilage, the same muscle, like you and I. So if you have any racist or racism, they put their blood in there. Leave it at the door, in the lobby, come here without that, and looking at you. When you leave, you pick up your resident and go. And that was the end of, and Charmaine, you were the supervisor, she said, well, you can't make a great decision, you know, take it case by case. If there was, I said, I don't have time for that. I have a clinic of 15 or 16, you know, kids here. You know, I don't have time to kowtowing you to some kid, you know, who has some problems. No. And this was at the height of apartheid in South Africa, by the way, in South Africa. So I just saw, I attempted this for racism, you know, I saw this in memory. So, needless to say that my center was the most popular. She actually had to do wait, raffles.
Yeah. Everybody wanted to see her, to work with her, because it was a different kind of experience. And the fact that she was a minority was new to them, but she was strict. And they liked that because they didn't have those structure before. And Miranda felt that they were workable.
Mm-hmm.
And after the first day, I would get reports, oh, but she's tough, but it's a good experience.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what Havana said is that she shared it. She was up front in confronting them with their feelings.
Mm-hmm.
That's
okay. Other strategies?
Well, our group characterized the clinic and fit to your scenario was talking about it helps. Mm-hmm. And that really is the kind of ultimate mm-hmm. strategy mm-hmm. kind of in some way. To talk about the phenomenon, and once people talk about it, then that usually helps 90% of what you're doing,
mm-hmm.
and then have a plan for whatever the real dangers are.
Mm-hmm.
Teach people about that,
right.
At least if it's young students, they, you know, they don't know how to drink, they don't know how to have sex, they don't know how to do home visits either. I mean, they don't know how to do anything until they're older. So they need help, a lot of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, this is not what we talked about, but me from what you said, I'm actually a psychiatric nurse practitioner, is what I used to do, and used to do therapy. And the rule, when I have patients who are anxious, the rule is always give them structure, because structure helps decrease anxiety, and help them talk about whatever it is they're feeling. Those are really the two things you do. And if you don't talk about the feeling, it eats you inside. And if you don't have structure, you're nervous all the time. You gotta have structure. That's key for what you said. It's maybe not as important what the structure is, but you've gotta have
structure. Yeah. Thank you. Those are good suggestions, some of which sounded like what I tried. First thing I did was to tell the parents that the students, that there wasn't an option. The students, I said, this is an experience that all the students must do. This is the only experience we have in public health nursing, and if the students are going to continue in nursing, this is what they have to do. So there was no compromise on that. The people at the health department were also, you know, the nurses, were wonderful. And there was one young nurse who was a good friend of mine and worked really hard for the students, little tiny blonde woman. And she came to the students and talked about myths about black people. She said, these are the myths you have about this community. And she said, this is the reality. And she would come every term and talk about that, at the point that that we were talking about, as you said, the orientation, the safety stuff. And at one point, we taped nurses from the health department talking about the community and their respect for the people that lived in the community. And we were able to use that tape with parents. And that helped a lot, too. The other thing this is the lesson that I really learned out of that. It would have been very easy for me to feel negatively about students that especially because I'm black. So, you know, you said, I don't want to go to this community. To me, that said, I don't want to take care of those African American people. But I had to, and this I thought about all people, I had to suspend whatever kind of whatever feelings I would have had about that. Because if I hadn't done that, I would not have been able to allow those students to grow. I had to say, here you are now. And I had to understand why they were there. This is the way you've been raised. These are the experiences you've had. But there is a possibility for you to move over here. But I have to accept you here before I can help you move here. And it worked. Many of my students, after they began to love the community, they loved the families that they visited. A number of them went into public health. But I think we had to confront, as you said, to provide the structure. The structure was, these are the things you can do to be safe, but you got to do this. And then to allow them to grow into a better way of thinking about people. As you said, we're human beings, and they begin to realize that. The other thing that I did in the didactic part was to talk a lot about issues of poverty. In those days, we didn't talk about social determinants as such, but you need to help people understand and move out of victim-blaming kinds of responses to people. So that was the other piece. But it was quite an experience. It was the richest experience I've ever had teaching public health. Not only because of the challenges, but then also because, you had mentioned, we had talked about, you could have had them go visit in pairs, but they wouldn't have had the same experience if they'd visited in pairs. They learned how to do public health nursing, yes. Well, I think, in the context of teaching public health, you're there in the health department, students are coming in and out, so you're making visits with them, you're there to talk to them. There are a lot of deep conversations, I think, that occur in that seminar situation and individually with students. I would be there some days reading charts. One student or two would be there, and we'd talk. So those opportunities are certainly there. In terms of what you said, you reminded me, before I left Michigan, at one point I was a charter member, I guess I'm still a member, of a purposefully multicultural church. We had a number of multicultural churches that just happened that way, but this was a purposefully multicultural church. And I remember the minister, one of the things that he wanted to work on was attitudes about women in leadership. And, of course, you know, we come out of this patriarchal thing. You know, these men didn't want to let women do anything. And his strategy was, and I remember he gave this sermon one day and talked about, you know, he said, you know, this is the way that women should be active in this church. And when we went out the door, all the women were just rejoicing, and the men were just, you know, you could see that they weren't too happy. But the principle that he operated on was this: I'm not going to try to convince you that this is what should be. We are going to do this. You're going to behave in this way. And he said the behavior will drive the attitudes, and it happened. It was amazing. And later, you know, like a year later, those men were saying, oh, well, you know, suddenly they learned that we can go to baby showers, you know, you know, women can do all these things. But he said that the attitudes are going to follow the behavior. And I had never seen that done. It's like you convince people this is what you ought to do. He said, no, this is what you're going to do. And eventually, by doing it, you begin to realize that this was the right thing to do. So hopefully, you know, I think that, you know, students that are able to check their racism at the door, eventually they grow to respect those families. My goal was that students would learn to respect poor families and would not only respect them, but to see the strengths of those families and to realize that those families had value and that they were competent. And I'm not sure how they started out, but at the end of the semester, most of them had reached that point where they were able to respect those families. But if I had waited till they changed their minds before I said, now you can go visit, they probably never would have done it. They had to go visit with all those fears and whatever kinds of negative values and whatever, and then they had to deal with it. But the reality, I think, convinced them that they needed to make some changes. Yeah.
I'm just questioning if that's, you know, in other words, if they maintain their feelings.
I think, let me just sum up, because I see now Carol is here. That's my twin sister Carol that's back there. Hi. Hi. Okay, Jean and Molly, that's okay. No, I think that's good, and we can think about, talk about this more as we go along. But I want to, at this point, go to a few didactic things, and Carol is here. We want to define cultural diversity. Culture. And I won't take a long time on these because these are familiar to you. But, culture relates to culture, society, everything that has to do with our social world and milieu. Diversity, the state of being diverse. So then cultural diversity, we talk about ethnic, gender, socioeconomic diversity, coexistence of different groups within a society. What is the reaction to this term in U.S. society? We won't have a chance to answer all these questions, but think about it. And what is the reaction to this term among people of color? Have you heard reactions to this term among people of color? Mm-hmm. Cultural diversity. How has that term been used among people of color? Or what do some people sometimes when people see this, what do they think?
You don't really use it until a problem pops up.
Truly. Yes. And sometimes, we've talked about racism, and we will talk about it more. But sometimes discussions about racism, racial prejudice, discrimination, the term cultural diversity sometimes gets used in a kind of, a euphemistic way. So you talk about cultural diversity and it kind of softens it, and we really don't come down to talking about the real bedrock issues. So we'll talk about this term, but think about that. So this is, you want to do it? Carol's here, and I'm going to run to the other session to get there.
Go downstairs. It'll take Renaissance Ballroom. You've got to go down several levels and go to the
Okay. Cheryl told you we're playing musical meetings. I love this exercise, and I don't know if you've seen it before. If the world were a village of 100 people, if we could reduce the population to this village, with all the existing human ratios remaining the same, the demographics would look something like this. Have you seen this before? Some have, some haven't. Okay, there would be 60 Asians, 14 Africans, 12 Europeans, 8 Latin Americans, 5 from the U.S. and Canada, 1 from the South Pacific. And 51 would be male, 49 would be female, 82 would be non-white, 18 would be white. 67 would be non-Christian, and that number, by the way, is growing. And 33 would be Christian. If the world were a village of 100, 80 would live in substandard housing. 67 would be unable to read. 50 would be malnourished, and 1 would be dying of starvation. 33 would be without access to safe water supply. 39 would lack access to improved sanitation. 24 would not have any electricity, and of the 76 that do, most would only use it for light at night. 21 would speak a Chinese dialect, and of these, 16 would speak Mandarin, 9 would speak English, 9 would speak Hindi, 7 would speak Spanish, 4 would speak Arabic, 4 would speak Bengali, and 3 would speak Portuguese. 3 also would speak Russian. 36 would be school-aged, between the ages of 5 and 24, and only 30 of them would attend school. 1 would be the teacher for those 30 students. 13 would not be able to read at all, and 2/3 of those who are illiterate would be women. And as you know, this is a tremendous public health problem. If the world were a global of 100, 7 would have access to the internet, 1 would have a college education. Wonder where that 1 would live. 1 would have HIV, Two would be near birth, and one would be near death. Five would control 32% of the entire world's wealth, and all five would be Americans. 33 would be receiving and attempting to live on only 3% of the income of the village. So when we think about that, it leads us to know that although we are rich and increased in goods, we're really a minority as Westerners, as Americans, as North Americans. So cultural competence becomes a huge issue for us, something that we really need to think about. It's defined as a very complex process developed over time by engaging in a variety of activities and sources of information. Developing competence is a lifelong process and is about continuous self-assessment and critical thinking. So you've got to do some work to remain culturally competent. It's not just learning information. It's looking at yourself. First of all, we've got to come to terms with our attitudes. We cannot render culturally competent health care unless we come to terms with our own attitudes toward those who are different from us. So what does it take for us to do this? We have to think about that. Here are the stages of intercultural sensitivity. We start out with denial. We don't recognize cultural differences. People say everybody's the same. Or defensive. We recognize some differences but see them as negative. And so we talk about those people who do that or are like that. The differences between them and us are negatives. Third stage is minimization. We're unaware of the projection of our own cultural values, and we see our values as superior to those of anyone else. And we'll come back to this because this is a big issue. Acceptance. Here we shift perspectives to understand that the same ordinary behavior can have different meanings in different cultures. So if I cross my leg sitting in a conversation with you and you see the sole of my foot, you probably wouldn't think much of it. But if I cross my leg sitting in a conversation with a person from the Middle East, they would be highly offended or making certain signs. You know, you do like this in the United States, that's a bad thing. It's not a bad thing everywhere. So ordinary behavior can have different meanings for different cultures. Adaptation. At this stage, we can evaluate others' behavior from their frame of reference and can adapt behavior to fit the norms of a different culture. So when I go to Uganda and I sit down as a guest, because I'm almost like an honorary man in Uganda or Malawi, and I sit down at the table to eat, and the host's wife and daughter come in with the food and serve me on their knees. What do I do about that? Do I say, get up off your knees, you're a woman? Or do I accept the food? Think about it. Finally, integration. Here you can shift the frame of reference and also deal with resulting identity issues. I can put myself in the place of someone else. Cultural stumbling blocks are important because these are the things that keep us from being culturally competent. Basically, a lack of understanding of groups other than one's own. Stereotyping of members of groups without consideration of individual differences within the groups. So all X are doing this and all Y are like that. Judgment of other ethnic groups according to the standards and values of one's own culture. Assigning negative attributes to the members of other cultures. And we play a game called ethnic slurs sometimes with students where we ask them to give me a couple of ethnic slurs and we paste them up on the wall. And we say, if you identify this, go and stand by it. All Polish are dumb. All Irish are drunks. All Puerto Ricans carry knives. All blacks are dirty. And we put them on the wall. Go and if you agree with it or disagree with it, go there and talk to each other about that. It's amazing the kinds of things that come out. Other stumbling block issues. View the quality and experience of other groups as inferior to those of one other's to those of one's own group. For example, prejudice, which is a hostile attitude among a particular group toward individuals simply because they belong to another group and they are presumed to have objectionable qualities. So I'm prejudiced against them. I remember when we were little, my mom had lived in New York. We lived in West Virginia. She lived in New York. And she had prejudice against people from Haiti. And so if she talked about someone that she considered to exhibit wild behavior, she said they're Haitians. And so we grew up thinking Haitians are wild because my mom was prejudiced against Haitians. And so when you said that word, immediately popped in your mind, wild. And so this is an attitude, and we all have prejudices, and we got to admit that. Discrimination is the differential treatment of individuals because they belong to a minority group. So prejudice is the attitude. Discrimination is the actual treatment of the group. Racism is a mixed form of prejudice and discrimination that's directed at groups other than one's own. And we'll come back to this again because this is an important concept. And as Cheryl said, we tend to not want to say this because the word brings up all kinds of negative and reactionary emotions within us. And so we say, well, we'll talk about something else. Racism doesn't exist, and in fact, it does. Ethnocentrism, an inability to accept other cultures' ways of organizing reality and considering one's own way as natural and best. And we are into this in many ways. And as nurses, I see a lot of my colleagues in here, we tend to have a nursing culture that's ethnocentric. So people's other ways of doing things that don't comport with our nursing culture are unacceptable to us. We look down upon other ways of doing so. People do herbal remedies, or they do something we consider weird in relationship to their health. And even if we patronizingly talk to them about it, we still think our way is best and something's wrong with what they're doing. Cultural paternalism, I know what's best for you attitude. Again, this characterizes us as nurses. So we say, speaking as a nurse, and then we're authoritative. Cultural blindness is ignoring differences and proceeding as if they did not exist. And you talk to people in minority groups, this is something that is infuriating to them. People will come up to you and they think they're giving you a compliment and they say, when I look at you, I don't see a black person. And I'm saying, what in the world do you see? I mean, do you see a woman? What do you see? But many people will say that. Cultural imposition is the expectation that everyone should conform to the majority, whatever their personal beliefs. So, when in Rome, do as the Romans do, sort of an ethic. But of all of these, stereotyping is the most common. That is saying, this is what everybody in this group does. And again, this is important for us as healthcare workers because oftentimes we have read books and we've been to classes and they say, well, Mexicans believe this and Chinese believe that. And so we go to the person's home or encounter them in the clinic or the hospital and we say, I know what you think. When I was a young public health nurse, I'll never forget, I went to the home of a Puerto Rican woman in Yonkers, New York, and I was supposed to be giving her the first well child visit after the birth of the baby. So I went through the bath, and you know all the stuff, you know, you pull out the bag and do the whole thing. And then I said, she's Puerto Rican and she's Catholic, so I'm not going to offend her by talking to her about birth control. So we got to the end of the visit, and I didn't say a word because I wasn't going to be offensive. And at the end of the visit, she said, when are you going to talk about birth control? And I said, lesson learned. Lesson learned. Here are 10 myths that inhibit cross-cultural understanding. One is simply by virtue of membership in a cultural group, a person will be able to deal with others of that population in a culturally competent way. Not true. A member of a minority community who works in a mainstream agency is able to represent his or her community. You got this token person, and whatever they think is generalizable to the whole group. A single member of the minority community can represent the whole. So I get my person out of the neighborhood, and they're going to tell me everything. An agency should choose a representative from a minority community to represent that community's interests to the agency. And this is one we do a lot. I've worked in agencies like that. There are so many ethnic communities, it is not feasible to have working relationships with them. And this is a way to stick our head in the sand and ignore people and their differences. Continuing, the Anglo or dominant culture is the U.S. culture, not simply a culture. Think about that one. Who's normative? The key differences in culture are lifestyle, language, foods, and similar visible evidence of diversity as often taught in diversity appreciation classes. So if I learn all these things, then I'm good to go. I understand everything. Cultural competence is something we pick up with time by working with persons who are different from ourselves. So I've worked with this person from India all these years, and so I understand about Indians. I'm ready to take care of Indians in a culturally competent way because I've known this person for years. Collecting information from community can be task-based rather than relationship-based. And this is something that plays up the differences between our Western way of looking at things and many people in the two-thirds world way of looking at things who depend on relationships. We look at a situation, we're going to do the work. So collecting information is task-oriented. I go and I ask questions, I give out surveys. It's not based on my knowing the people in their families and in their communities, relationship-based. It's a big difference. What you learn if you approach learning from a relationship basis rather than a task-oriented basis. Written information is more reliable, valid, and substantial than verbal information. Many of the cultures that you deal with are oral cultures. Even if they have a lot of written material about them, when you talk to the people themselves, you get an entirely different perspective. That's really important. Communication styles is another thing that helps us to be culturally competent. So we've got to look at animation and emotion. Some people are very, very placid or stolid. They don't show emotion. We talk about the inscrutable East. Some people show their emotion in their faces. You don't have to even talk to them much. You see what's going on. You can read it. And so this is something we've got to think about. You know, how people, some people use a lot of hand gestures and others use none whatsoever. Directness or indirectness. Many people in the two-thirds world, especially in cultures where face is important, deal indirectly. So rather than directly confronting or saying things directly, they will say things in an oblique way. They'll tell a story. They'll recite a proverb. But they'll come at it in an indirect way. So this is something that we must be aware of. Eye contact is very important. In the Western culture that we live in, if you don't look a person straight in the eye, you are something dishonest. You're being shifty and you lack candor. But in many cultures, eye contact is almost like having eye contact with a dog that's about to bite you. You don't look people in the eye, especially people above you socially, especially your teacher or your parent or grandparent or an older person, so that when I know in education, you know, people will say to me, teachers, oh, that student is shifty. They couldn't even maintain eye contact. Well, that student's from another culture, and they would consider it an affront to maintain eye contact, and yet they've been judged negatively because we don't understand what eye contact means to them. Gestures, as I said, are important. Some people do a lot, and we've got to know what the gestures mean. Different gestures mean different things. And knowing that, you know, the basic is really, really helpful. Identity orientation. How does a person see themselves in the culture? Do they see themselves individually, as we do in Western culture, or do they see themselves as members of a group? And the group is more important than the individual. Turn-taking and pause time. In some cultures, people want to, they want to take their turn. So when you speak, they expect you to stop at a point and then they can speak without being interrupted. Or they spend a long time thinking about what they're going to say. So Cheryl tells me about some of our friends from Alaska, from the Alaska Native community. They will take a long time and think about what they're going to say. And you've got to be silent. You can't interrupt. So people don't just speak quickly. And this is important to know. That kind of thing. Also, that people are, especially elders, are respected and allowed to talk. And those people tell stories a lot. We have a friend named George Charles. He's got a PhD. He, until he became ill, ran their center for elders for Hawaiian, Native Hawaiian American Indians there in Anchorage. And he was at a meeting of their university, and George got up to speak, and the new chancellor, who knew nothing or cared nothing about Alaska Native culture, was chairing the meeting, and George started to speak, and he always tells stories, and they're wonderful stories, they're funny, but he was talking about something serious, but he was telling a story, and that woman interrupted George, and a gasp went up over the audience, and that woman was not chancellor long. Mm-hmm. But that was the beginning of her downfall, that she interrupted. People could not believe it, that she had done that. Space is important. Some people want can accept you being closer than others. Some need more personal space. People need more space in the back than they do in the front, depending on their culture. It's important to know that. Time is important. We'll come back to that. Because many times people are judged negatively based on how they relate to time. And we impose our Western notions of time and its importance on people for whom relationships are much more important. Touch. Some cultures are very, very touchy-feely. Others never touch. And this is important to know. Vocal patterns. Some people are very emotional and excited in their vocal patterns. Others are calmer. Many people that I have met, and I love this, people from Southern Africa, people that I know from Zimbabwe, from South Africa, from Tanzania, Rwanda, they speak in soft tones. And to me, I love it. You know, because their voices are so soft and gentle. But many times they come to our classrooms and we say, well, that person's not speaking up. But it's not their culture to speak up. They're speaking as they do, and we've got to accommodate to that. And certainly people's thought patterns and rhetorical styles, how do they communicate? How do they think and how do they communicate rhetorically? Again, many cultures, it's telling stories. So we've got to be able to sit down and listen to the story and listen analytically to the story so we understand what they're getting at, because that's how they're going to give us information. Here are the cognitive components of cultural competence. First of all is awareness, the perception of your cultural worldview and consciousness of your reaction to people who are different. So we've got to start out becoming aware of who we are and how we think in our worldview, and we'll come back to that in just a bit. Attitude, the difference between your awareness of cultural bias and beliefs in general and your examination of your beliefs and values about cultural differences. And here's where you've got to be honest with yourself. What are my values? How do I evaluate other people? What cultural biases do I hold? And if you tell me you have no biases, you're not being honest with yourself or me, because all of us have biases. Knowledge, this is a comprehension of different cultural practices and worldviews, and we gain this in many ways, not just didactically, but relationally. And skills, cross-cultural capabilities such as verbal and nonverbal communication that allow you to practice cultural competence. So we've got to learn some things and unlearn some things in order to be culturally competent. Cultural humility is another important component of competence. This concept was developed in reaction to the idea that one could achieve a state of ongoing cultural competence based on a supposed understanding of the culture of others. Cultural humility is an experience of lifelong self-reflection and self-critique of your own culture and an ongoing process of exploring with those of other cultures the similarities and differences among your varying perceptive. It is based on an attitude of respect, openness, and flexibility. That means you've got to talk to people. And you've got to talk to them over a period of time to really become culturally competent. So you've got to use the opportunities that you have. So when you get to come into contact with people of other cultures, you know, you should try to quickly move beyond the superficial kinds of contacts we have. Oh, where are you from? How many children do your parents have? You know, did you live in a village? You know, tell me something about the culture. But really get down to understanding how people think and feel. And that means some exposure of yourself. How do I think and feel? What kind of biases do I have? What kinds of things really divide us? What kinds of things are really different, things that I can work on and try to understand? So here's some exercises in self-reflection. Now, I'm going to ask you to think about the first four, and then we're going to take a little time to deal with the last one. So identifying your own culture and family beliefs and values, and think about these later. Define your own personal culture, identity, your ethnicity, age, experience, education, socioeconomic status, religion, whatever. Are you aware of your personal biases and assumptions about people with different values from yours? Challenge yourself in identifying your own behaviors as the norm. But this is the one I want us to talk about. Describe a time, and let's have about two people talk about. Describe a time when you became aware of being different from other people. Then you have two volunteers. Yes.
What came to my mind, I didn't experience, I think somebody mentioned this already about when you become the minority, and as a white woman, you know, in this country, usually, you know, I'm usually in the majority population, but I do some work within the District of Columbia school system with public health nurses in the schools. In one of the first meetings I went to, I was one of about 5 white nurses among about 250 African-American, mostly African-American nurses. This was probably 15 or 20 years ago. And the director of the program, who I talked to before, we had a conversation, phone relationship, but we hadn't met very often. And when it was my turn to come up and speak, she pointed to one of the other white women in the room and said, Susan, come on up. And we sort of looked at each other, and it's like, to us, it's like, she doesn't look like me, I don't look like her, but she thinks I'm her because there was just a handful of white people. And then it got it to the stereotype that people hear about, black people look alike. So then I was the other where, white people look alike, you know?
Yes.
So that was a time when that happened to me.
Somebody else. Thank you for that.
Like this is a little hardwired in, and so I'm pretty sure most of the time that I'm behaving correctly, you know. So it always surprises me when I'm walking down the street and all of a sudden I realize, I'm afraid of that person because of the color of their skin or they're carrying a bottle or something, you know. So it's not a time when I was aware. It's like I'm always surprised when it sort of pops into my awareness. I mean,
It is.
It feels like it's hardwired in, and I repress it, so I get by most of the time, okay, and then I'll be in a situation. I guess I wasn't like I thought about.
There was I watched some little vignettes on YouTube when I was working on this presentation, and they showed this vignette of a. It was a boutique, very high cost clothing store in New York, and they had programmed the sales clerk to behave in a certain way, and they had a person come in again who was an actress to play like she was a customer. So this woman comes into the boutique. She was very, very casually dressed, like blue jean jacket, whatever. She's black. And so they were trying to look at the reaction of other people in the store. The sales clerk went up to this woman and said, "Get out of this store. I've seen people like you in here before. We've had trouble, and I know you're not here for any good, and you just got to leave right now." And so the woman protested. So she brought the store manager, and they said, "Well, we're going to frisk this woman." So they patted her down. And the first couple that were there were a man and a woman, white man and white woman. So they went out of the store. And the host of the program came up to them and said, "Did you notice what just happened in the store?" And they said, "Yes." And before they went out, they talked to the clerk. The woman left the store, so they talked to the clerk, this man and woman that were customers. And the clerk said, "Oh, these people are always doing this, and I know what they're here for, trying to steal, whatever." And so the man said to her, I bet she played the race card. And she said, "Yes, she did." And so then the man went out of the store, and the host of the program accosted him and said, "This was an experiment, and we did this to see what your reaction would be." The man then said, "Oh, how terrible it was how that woman was treated." I mean, he completely flip-flopped. You thought about, how did that woman feel? I mean, she was an actress, but how would she feel? But then one of the other customers that was in the store, when they did the same thing again, when another group of customers were there, was a young Hispanic woman. And so when she saw this happening, she said, "Oh no, this isn't happening." So she went there to listen. And as this clerk continued to abuse this woman, she would sort of talk to her, and the woman was going to say, "Oh, I know how they always do." And the woman said, "Oh, I know what you're going to say. Don't say it." You know, she was relating to the black woman as another person of color. And so she was feeling very much what this woman was feeling. So every time this woman was about to come out with a racist statement, she said, "Oh, no, you're not going to say it." Eventually, the woman just broke down and cried, the young Hispanic woman. And they had to really comfort her and say, this was just something that was enacted. But she identified so strongly with this woman as being someone that was different and how it felt, and it brought her to tears. You know, I'm being treated differently. So it's interesting to sort of deal with that kind of thing. Our worldviews are important. Worldview is your lens on reality, how we view, how we process. Our whole mental upholstery, so to speak. Our worldviews are based on our social locations, and they are socially constructed. I learned the worldview based on where I am located socially. So I'm a black person in America, and I have learned a worldview. And you have learned a worldview based on who you are and where you're from. And then you've also learned little subsets of your worldview. So if you're a nurse, a social worker, a dietitian like my friend Linda, you learn a worldview that's associated with that. But they're very strong, and they are the way that we process reality. For most of us, as middle-class public health professionals, we share the values of the dominant culture, no matter what color we are. Many public health professionals have an elitist educational worldview. We're very well educated. You know, we see each other all the time, and we think, well, this is the norm. This is not the norm. Most people are not nearly as well educated as you are. Not nearly. And so we have a certain worldview that's based on that. We do not identify with the underclass, and they do not identify with us. And if we think they do, we are living in la-la land. I remember my husband and some colleagues of his at university where we were trying to get together the young black males, and they were going to have like an overnight with them, and they were trying to encourage them and inspire them. And you know what those kids said to them? They said, "We don't identify with you at all. In fact, you are a threat to us because you are so well-educated." These professors that were trying to deal with them, they said, you're not a part of us at all. And the fact that you are where you are is threatening to us because this is an expectation that's put on us. Interesting. Let me give you a cautionary tale. When I was teaching at the University of Michigan, I taught in the graduate maternal child program. And I would show the students this film, because I did the community part for them. I would show the students this film called This is the Home of Mrs. Levant Graham. Have any of you ever seen that? It's a wonderful video. It's like cinema verity, and it's the day in the life of this family living in Washington, D.C. in very poor circumstances. But there were all kinds of strengths in that family. You know, they sat down to eat together. The kids were being encouraged to get their education. They had love and support. I mean, there was a man and a woman both involved in the family. They were not on welfare. They were buying their home, but they were poor, and they lived in this old broken down place. And one of the students, who was a good friend of mine, one of the graduate students, she's from a Caribbean background, and she put up her hand and said, "I don't know anybody like that. I don't know anybody that lives like that. I don't have any commonality with that kind of a family. These people are not like me." And I was shocked. But she was coming from a family that had been well-educated over generations, had money, you know, lived an upper-middle-class lifestyle, and she's saying, "These people have nothing in common with me." And I said, "My Lord." But many times that is our attitude. These people are different from us. They're not like us. We embrace W.E.B. Du Bois' concept of the talented tenth. You know, we're going to deal with the people that are intelligent. You've got to keep me in terms of time. What time is this supposed to end?
10 o'clock. This one's 10 and the second
one. Okay, so I got about 5 more minutes, right? Okay. Every patient or client encounter is a cultural encounter. So if we think about that, if that's the assumption on which we operate, every time I deal with someone, be it a student, a colleague, a client, a patient, every time I deal with someone, it's a cultural encounter. And try to understand it from that perspective.
Is that the Du Bois
talented tenth? What Du Bois said was, that, and he's talking about black people, he said there is a talented tenth of black people. And these people should be encouraged and given every opportunity and education and everything. These people that have the innate ability to achieve. And so he thought that what we needed to do was concentrate on the talented tenth, and the rest of these folks could just sort of do whatever. And many times we have that attitude too. So we'll look at a culture and we'll select the people that we think are bright or intelligent, have some kind of aptitude or ability, and we will deal with those people and sort of let the others go and say, well, these people are different from you. You're not like them. You're going to achieve. You're going to do this. And it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. Those people in the lower 90% can't really make it, and they don't because of what we project to them. So let's end with, how much diversity are you experiencing? Turn to the person next to you and talk to them quickly about the types of diverse cultural groups that you encounter in your institution or organization. Just give them the names. Indians, South Africans, Hispanics, who do you deal with? Talk briefly. Take a few more seconds. Just list them off. Okay, let me ask you a question. Did anyone say white? Hold up hands. Did anyone say white is a diverse cultural group that you deal with in your practice? One person. Why didn't the rest of you say white? Why? But did you list white as a cultural group?
No.
Why not?
Because that's not what I happened to deal with when I was talking to...
None of you deal with white people in your practice? Yes. Huh? Right. But did you think about white people as a culture or Caucasian people as a cultural group? Many times we don't. They're not diverse cultural group. They're the norm.
Mm-hmm.
You talked about them related to the diagnoses more.
Well,
yeah.
Probably that or a different lifestyle.
Okay. And that can be a diverse group, yes.
We talked about a refugee help program where we had at one point 21 different languages.
Mm-hmm. Yes, many times that's how we identify people. But think about, and I'm bringing you back to it, think about the fact that most of us do not think about white people as a diverse cultural group. White people are the norm and everybody else is diverse, yes. Virginia, and I went year before last, to give a presentation to the West Virginia State University, Bluefield State, on cultural diversity. And when we talked about it, there was a distinct difference, and it was sort of based on counties where people lived, whether they lived in the more coalfield parts as others. But the people that were from Appalachia, the people that could identify themselves with that culture, were seen as very different and in many ways denigrated. So it was interesting when I sat down with the faculty to talk about difference, the people that were actually Appalachian talked about their feelings. They had a few faculty members that were Appalachian. Most of them were mainstream, and there were all kinds of social distinctions made. But most times, white people will not identify themselves as culture. Let me quickly go down so we can let you go and have your lunch or your snack. How does your institution, and these are things for you to think about, how does your institution or organization respond to diversity? And I've been at schools where it's celebrated, and other schools where this is the worst thing that ever came down the pike. Is it celebrated? Is it ignored? Are there specific programs to help diverse persons? And some places have them, some places don't. Think about your place of work. What is your gut reaction to the diverse people you encounter in your program? When I was teaching at the University of Michigan in the graduate program, we had students placed in health departments around Ann Arbor. And the public health nurses there, when they encountered people, Appalachian people who had moved there, was so negative you could not believe it. They talked about them like yard dogs. The same way I encountered people in California talked about gypsies. Oh, these gypsies, they've 40 of them come into the hospital room and they won't get out and they're doing this and they're doing that. And they no understanding of the culture. So their gut reaction, gypsies, something's wrong. Something's bad about these gypsies. Do you view them as an asset or a disadvantage? And we'll stop there. And I'll see you later.